Gary Butterfield.
My name is Cole Ross.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs Dispatch, our monthly Q&A, listener response, game announcement episode.
Yeah, where we're talking about a bunch of stuff. We're going to end by reading your responses to June's games. Action-packed, month this month. Mm-hmm. Sorry, little...
Action-packed month this month
is what we have this month. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then announcing what we're going to be covering in August. So stick around.
Summer JRPG month.
Mm.
Yeah.
What's it going to be?
You'll never know unless you fast forward. And if you do, you're a coward.
Mm.
Listen to the whole episode, Jack.
What did Jack do? Jack's perfectly nice.
He's fast forwarded to the end before. I believe. let's get started here. I'm going to get started here with Tanuki Boot. Tanuki Boot says, I'm curious if you guys have a game that you find to be excellent, but never recommend to people because it doesn't seem to resonate or has a component that serves as a roadblock. To clarify, not a game that you know is shit, but love regardless. One of those for me has to be Mischief Makers. The game just comes off as kind of a slog until you get the hang of utilizing various dashing methods to blast through levels. Yeah, I love to use various dashing methods to go through levels.
I like to navigate spaces and challenges in order to reach a goal.
Yeah, love to blast. We just recorded our Duck Feed Presents on the I Think You Should Leave Season 3 tier list, mm-hmm. so we get our energy up, but it resulted in us being punchy.
Uh-huh.
We're not making fun of you, Tanuki Boot.
Nope.
We're just making fun of words.
This one, my answer is going to be boring because it's like really like just a like practical more than anything. Mm-hmm. Peripheral based rhythm games. Like I can't think of a better way to like kill an hour than to just fuck around in a Rock Band or a Guitar Hero or even mm-hmm. like a Rocksmith. Right. I think Rocksmith is mm-hmm. a fun experience, you know, even if you're not using it as a learning tool, right? But man, that requires stuff, expensive stuff now, and it's space and things. And it's a limiting factor that kind of like keeps me from talking about them as much as I actually spend time playing them.
Yeah, it's a lot of that can actually apply fully to VR stuff too.
Oh yeah.
Especially room scale stuff. Like space is a premium, mm-hmm. you know, and sadly it's gonna become more of one as the economics, and stuff continue to suck.
Uh-huh.
I have a billion answers for this. A lot of my all-time favorite games are old CRPG masterpieces that take, they're hard to get into. So like, I fully believe my heart of hearts that something like Baldur's Gate 2 or Fallout 2 or Deus Ex are worth every gamer's time.
Mm-hmm.
These are important to the medium and put a lot of modern games to shame mm-hmm. with their qualities, but they have UI stuff that's not modern, so people struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one I always think about with this is Darkest Dungeon,
which is
one of my all-time favorite games, but it is hard and counterintuitive.
Yes.
So you have to be down for those things.
Yeah. And the only reason I didn't lead with it because I didn't want to be a parody of myself, but Pathologic. I think it is absolutely worth the squeeze, but it is a hell of a squeeze. And, not gonna presume that somebody's got that in them.
It's interesting how maybe 10, 15 years ago, Dark Souls would have been an answer for this, or 10 years ago, Dark Souls would have been a reasonable answer for this. But now that gaming has kind of caught up
mm-hmm.
to that, it doesn't feel that weird.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't feel like that much of an ask, like Elden Ring, one of the biggest games of all time. It sold really well. People can handle a little Dark Souls.
One of the weird ways in which the world got better.
Yeah. One of the only ways.
Yeah. Retro says, or asks, I'm not sure, the CEO of a game studio is a fan of WAF and respects your critique and insights on game design. Would you ever be interested in, I don't think that's actually the true, what's God going on. It. I think that this is a hypothetical. I'm sorry. I got my hopes up too. Yeah. would you ever be interested in being brought on board a project to help shape its development? A decent salary would be provided and contracts would be part-time so Duckfeed can continue as is. Do you accept? Would it depend on factors such as genre and theme, etc., or would it not be something that would even interest you? All hypothetical, of course.
I think this is interesting. It wouldn't have to do so much with like genre and theme in a specific way. Mm-hmm. I would want it to be something where like the specific things that I think make a game good could apply.
Yeah.
You know, so like, for example, somebody brought me on for like a character action game or something. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know dick about that. And the thing that would make that something I would like more mm-hmm. would largely be to like get rid of it and make it a different genre. You know,
right.
I wouldn't want my answer to be throughout the entire premise because I know that's not useful.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, sure. I think that sounds cool. I think mm-hmm. it'd be really fun and be fun to be able to say I did. And it would be very useful for us as critics to get like
mm-hmm. any insight into the creation works. Process. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great. It's yeah. That'd be cool.
I'm just going to answer this question with a simple yes. And, you know, echo no genre constriction other than it needs to be a game that I believe in and is interesting.
Yes. You know?
I don't want to go on any further because just the idea of presuming that I would have anything to say to people doing actual work on this is it makes me want to just clench into myself.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to, this person asked, I didn't volunteer it.
Yeah. 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 I get it. The, I think that would be cool. Yep. Is my answer. Ben asks, do y'all ever think about game sales in the digital marketplace? Sometimes when I'm poking around the PSN store, I find myself thinking, I wonder if anyone in the world bought Fallout 4 today. Do you think ever a day passes where a big release doesn't get a single online sale? What about Dying Light? Is there a steady new handful of people purchasing a game like that every day? Just curious about your brain number estimations. Thanks for all the great shows. I've thought about this before, but it doesn't just very, very idly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and generally the way it comes up to me is not with like big things like that. It's like I'll buy something that is old and be like for work. I bought I downloaded on the PlayStation Plus thing the PS5 port of Jack 2.
Oh, yeah.
I'm probably going to play that in emulator because it's going to benefit a lot from save states. Mm-hmm. But I just downloaded it to play it. And I was like, I might be the only person in the world who downloaded this today. You know,
you start getting into like almost like a shirt brother kind of thing. Like,
yes,
are we bound? Is this some kind of, what's the opposite of a grand falloon, Gary?
Yeah. There is no opposite in the story.
Okay.
Of it.
Okay. Yeah. just accidentally falling into just a carass. There we go. I knew
that's what you're looking for, but I wouldn't say it's an opposite of a grand flume.
Right. Right. Just a grand flume being a false carass. Yeah.
Yes.
Like Hoosiers, Hoosiers are a grand flume. Yeah, I think about.
You got distracted remembering things from Cat's Cradle.
I did. Yeah. I did.
I was it thinking, man, the best of us.
I was thinking, man, that's a good book. I think about this when I am like going into a sale. Like I was trying to think of games for my vanity picks, you know. So mm-hmm. I went on, PlayStation Plus because I get a bunch of games through that, and I scrolled. You know, at the top is all the popular stuff. Here's your God of War. Here's your Mortal Kombat. Blah blah blah. And I just kept on going down and down and down. And I was like, nobody's ever fucking played this.
Yeah,
which obviously isn't true. But then you have to think, like, if a game got 365 sales, that would be a, you know, depending on the studio, that would be pretty low numbers. But that also means like one person would buy it a day on aggregate. So,
yeah. So, and that's very low and it still is one a day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I think there probably are games where that's true. Like one thing I you probably already knew this, but this is just a Doki Doki fact I just realized because mm-hmm. I was high out of my mind before going to bed and reading about Balan Wonderland.
Oh yeah,
and just like, oh yeah, that sold 2,000 physical copies.
Jesus. Jesus Christ.
In like the first week. It's like anything that's lower than our listenership is pretty amazing in terms of a big number.
And then you know, Yuji Naka went to jail.
Yeah, I've never made an album that sold 2,000 copies. Like, so it's not like I'm poo-pooing that in general. Uh-huh. But boy, is that fucking wild. You know? So I think that like if you were to buy Bell in Wonderland, not on a big sale event, like Bell in mm-hmm. Wonderland at full price, you might be the only person to buy it.
Yeah.
To buy it.
That's a fun Wikipedia page to go to, like the lowest grossing movies.
Oh yeah.
And it's always because it had to air in like one small theater in Nevada in order to satisfy a contract or whatever. So it was like one showing, but it's still fun to just like, okay, so like what stories did somebody feel is worth telling?
Yeah. And so it's from, and also when you get to the actual big actual failures too, released, you know, nationwide.
Doug writes, it's been interesting to listen to the Sexy Brutale episode and hear your thoughts on how overly simplistic it is. I have no opinion on it myself. I haven't played it. But is there a space for low impact games? Often after completing a fairly large game, I'll want something breezy as a palate cleanser. Maybe Sexy Brutale isn't a good one, but is there a space for games like that? And how does it affect your evaluation of them?
For me, less so as I get older. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to be more into that, and now I don't want like low impact. I get through familiarity. Mm-hmm. You know, like to me, a roguelite is low impact. Like a roguelike, like doing Binding of Isaac is low impact because mm-hmm. I know it very well. It's not so simple. I don't want to play anything that is just a button pressing children's book, which is what Sexy Brutale is. Like it, I can't do that simple.
Yeah,
And it's a big reason why I've fallen out of love with a lot of traditional JRPGs, because a lot of times the gameplay is that simple. I don't want that.
No.
You know, I don't want to play EDF. I don't want to play Zone of the Enders. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm just tapping buttons, that's no good. Yeah. So I also want palettes cleansed, but I don't want them in that very popular form factor. And if it's going to be something that simple, I would still rather play something like A Short Hike. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a 1 hour walking sim or 1 hour art game, then play a full campaign that has the is dressed up as something that has complexity to it and then has none.
I think that's a bummer. That last part is a huge deal because like in, you know, using Sexy Brutale as the operative example, that seemed like it was going to be a fun adventure game where you were solving time puzzles. Because mm-hmm. for all the world, that was the promise that it seemed to make in a tutorial and such. And then it just wasn't. You know, if something comes out and you watch a Nintendo Direct and you see a farming game, or you watch the fucking Cozy Game Showcase and see like Alpaca Boulangerie, mm-hmm. you know, like you kind of know what that's going to be. Like that is advertising a product for a person who is looking for it. And I've got no quarrel with that. Like, and that is the place for it. It's just when something kind of catfishes you that like the disappointment is there.
I think I agree with that, but I also, for me, I have no place for Alpaca Boulangerie personally. And I think more games catfish you. Not that many do it as bad as Sexy Brutale.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of game, you know, something like Zone of the Enders is, I think, as mechanically simple mm-hmm. as Sexy Brutale is, and is catfishing the same way. I think that catfishing kind of element happens more often than you might think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where there's just like the emperor just literally has no clothes. There's nothing to this.
Mm-hmm.
That happens a lot. And I always want to have to be there in a video game. You know, mm-hmm. there are exceptions where I'm just reading a book. Those are rare for me. Like you'll go see the Pentiment episode. I was very surprised that broke through all my defenses. Mm-hmm. It's cause it's a really good book.
Yeah.
But that's rare.
Yeah. And I have a place for, you know, visual novel or stuff that's as close enough
like Power Wash Simulator and stuff too. Like,
there's
a meditation game thing that you're into.
Mm-hmm. But like, you know, just when it comes to like visual novels or like, you know, stuff that's basically might as well be like a Phoenix Wright or a Danganronpa, like that's fucking manga. I'm doing that instead of reading manga at that point.
Yeah. Right? It doesn't feel like a game. Yeah. I'm not saying it's not a game, and I'm not saying that like, you know, it doesn't gain anything from mm-hmm. being a video game. Like there's a scale with that too.
Yeah,
like, you know, the question of if something requires being a game, something can benefit from a game, mm-hmm. but the degree that it benefits is important
mm-hmm.
too. You know, Yeah. It can't just be, it adds value at all.
Yeah.
It has to add enough value. And it's not always to justify just playing it, you know, it being a game, but it's also to justify the length as compared to other products that would tell the same story. See, for me, the argument that Night in the Woods would have been a better comic. You know, I don't really feel like, yes, does it add some game things? Sure. There are some mini games. You can choose the order you talk to characters in. But does it add enough? I would say no. For me. So, Ethan says, hello. I was wanting to know, what are the dumbest DLCs you've ever purchased and or the dumbest reason for buying a DLC? For me, the DLC that answers both these questions has to be the Feast Day Gifts and Pranks Pack Dragon Age Origins.
Jesus.
That's bleak.
Christmas DLC for a BioWare game. No, no.
The Pranks Pack. I ran into an unfortunate bug where a party member's personal quest wouldn't trigger. Turns out, in some cases, the quest would only become available when approval was sitting at exactly 65, which I had long passed. I couldn't lower approval through quest, and loading a previous save would have meant losing hours of progress. But I had an out. For only $3, the Feast Day Gifts and Prank Pack would let me buy coal and cake so I could manually alter companion approval. As I gifted lumps of coal one by one until this companion's... I'm going to kill myself before the end of this. This is so fucking bleak. Like, send a well-being check before I get to the end of this paragraph. As I gifted lumps of coal one by one until this companion's approval was at 65, I was able to reflect on the artificiality of Dragon Age's gift system. Not the best $3 I've ever spent, but at least I finished that quest. You know, when I say that, I'm not begrudging you at all, Ethan. Like, I'm begrudging the shit out of BioWare, though. That's one of the bleakest things I've ever heard.
Yeah, I'm not begrudging you, Ethan, on this, because it sounds like you learned something from it. And an experience where it caused you to say, like, oh, hey, maybe this is bullshit that I'm spending time doing this.
My God.
You know, it just, it's... there could be a bunch of bad things laying around, but if you put them all in a row, you realize, oh no, this is all those bad things in a row.
Imagine Pac-Man, instead of picking up pack pellets, like, he just stepped in turds, but he just kept doing it until you get to the end and there's like a big turd you eat. You know, that's kind of what that paragraph of having to buy a pack to carefully manage through cakes and coals, the various numbers that represented friendship. As just an absolute time capsule of video games not understanding human relationships.
Bone chilling.
Yeah, absolutely bone chilling. That's a micro fiction right there. The worst DLC I ever bought. I've never bought anything for that. Like, usually I will not buy non-content DLC. Yeah. I bought the alternate music pack for Resident Evil 4 Remake, but I don't regret that.
No.
The worst, probably though, and every once in a while I'll buy something because it'll end up being shitty. Yeah. So, like, I remember being very excited for Fallout 3's DLCs and then going through Op Anchorage and Mothership Zeta and being like, this fucking sucks.
Yeah.
I hate this. Why am I going through this?
You had no reason to believe it was going to be bad, though. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Some of the worst DLCs I've played.
Mm-hmm.
So I have ones I've purchased that are bad, but not because the game was fundamentally broken.
Right. Yeah. For me, like, I never fell for Horse Armor or whatever. Like, I bought some dumb songs on Rock Band. Like, when I got the set back out and started playing it for Exercise, the drum specifically, I was going through and just buying a bunch of DLC because I figured it'd be delisted soon. And I was like, I don't know, there might be at some point, I'm going to at least play through All-Star once. Like, yeah. You know, like, whatever. Well,
and that's content.
Yeah,
and it's added value that will be permanent. Mm-hmm. And like, a song can be awful to listen to, but fun to play on Rock Band.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I got no problem with that. Like, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. That's the only one that comes to mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see. Let's do one more game question, Gary.
Sounds
and move
good.
On to some other types.
Yeah, we had a lot of responses. So this episode might end up being, the Q&A part might be a little light.
Yes. Fermented Sorcerer writes, achievements in games are a manipulative system that rewards obsessive behavior and makes a fortune for the developer by capitalizing on our engagement and securing as much of our free time as possible. Nevertheless, they seem integral to the structure of games, and being rewarded in some way for completing goals is almost the point of playing. Even if you don't care about the achievements, they are impossible to ignore, and the plink sound you hear when you've just completed a level is chemically satisfying. Do y'all ever feel compelled by gamer score or trophy level system? How do y'all think the current achievement system has contributed to your own gaming experiences?
I am a hardline extremist about this. Mm-hmm. I think these can be good only to the degree that encourage alternate play. Mm-hmm. And it's so rare that a game does that well. Yeah. And even if they do it well, there are other ways to do it. Mm-hmm. I would strike this from the earth if I could. Every single time a little achievement pops up, it is the best thing that can happen is I didn't notice it. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's never additive to me. I don't get a Pavlovian thing. I don't feel good about it. It feels intrusive. I hate a thing where I've been playing Darkest Dungeon 2. Mm-hmm. And it kept bugging me to sign into my Epic account.
Oh, God.
So I finally did it. And what it means now is every time I boot it up, I get this big list of achievements I got last time.
Nope. I played. Don't care.
It doesn't do anything. Like, I'm just playing the game. Mm-hmm. Like, I was going to beat, you know, this level anyway, because mm-hmm. I want to play the game. You already have me. You know, yeah. Like, I don't understand the selling past the close thing. Like, if the game is not fun enough to play on its own, a little badge that pops up is not going to make it fun enough mm-hmm. on its own. I would love to destroy this, go back in time and just like literally erase it from reality.
Mm-hmm.
I hate
them at the system level, you know, like where it's a profile and it's supposed to be like a social thing and people can, you know, go through. I'm not convinced anybody has ever looked at anybody else's achievements.
I love to compare myself to other people for fun.
Yeah.
I just really want to see what my friends have done and see if I can beat them.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I'm going to spend my limited time on Earth. Like,
I turn off the notifications for them. If and ever it is an option, you mm-hmm. know, sometimes like with that Darkest Dungeon thing, it's not. I guess you can just not sign in, but who knows what
it's
you're missing.
By, you can't sign out.
Oh.
Like I can sign out, but I've tied it to my account.
Oh no.
So like, that's what it kept, but it kept pinging me until I did it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, why not make playing video games a cool, fun party destination, you know, where you hang out with your friends and you compare. And I'm like, why? No, I just talk to my friends normally. You don't have to gamify or incentivize that.
Yeah, no human has ever enjoyed that. And I'm sure somebody is thinking, I'm going to tweet them and say, actually, no, I get a lot of value off of that. You're not real either.
I'm barely on Twitter. Do your worst.
The only time an achievement has worked is when it is like within the game and it is tied to progression or content. I am thinking very specifically of the best achievement system of all time, which is Into the Breach.
Yeah.
Which
didn't
just
need to be an achievement system.
They could just call it something else.
Yeah. It could just be unlocks, you know. The other allowance I'll make are jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Hitting the Andrew Ryan statue in Bioshock 2 with the golf club mm-hmm. and it referencing the first one. That's as good a way to do that. I'd rather have that than my character just be like, seems familiar in a Borderlands way or something.
Ugh.
But at the same time, if what I get from that is not worth what I pay.
Yeah.
For them in general, like those very, very few bright shining moments, I would easily trade away.
And that can go bad in a lot of ways. Just I'm flashing back to Tyranny when
is Sparta.
Yeah, you kick that guy off the tower, and then it says this is Sparta. Yeah. Like no, miss.
Yeah,
miss me with that shit.
Super miss. There's so little baby and so much bathwater in that system. It's one tiny baby drowning in all the oceans of the world.
It's one of those little babies that you're freezing in an ice cube.
Yeah. and put into a gigantic party pitcher of margs. Like it's in a marg tower built for four. It's so bad. I hate it so much. Moving on to life questions. Malachi, great name, says, mm-hmm. bad news. Your long lost uncle has died. Well, what a horrible way to find out, Malachi. Good news. In their will, you are allotted what is effectively infinite money for you to purchase and build your dream home. You can accomplish and acquire basically anything that money could get you. For myself, I'd like a cabin in the foothills of Tennessee, just big enough for me and my wife, with a creek within earshot. It would be far enough into the woods that it could only be found if I were to show you where it was. I would also use my vast wealth to run a high-speed internet connection out there. Don't judge. I was going to get you with that internet thing.
Mm, yeah. No, my version is basically the same, except for an island on the Great Lakes.
I want a gigantic mansion full of secret passages and stuff that is outside of the city, but close enough for access. Mm-hmm. You know, like in one of the we have a couple really cute suburbs, mm-hmm. Not like Gresham and Beaverton, not like the big suburbs, but little mm-hmm. things we have near. I would like to have a big house like that. I like room. Something I've noticed that I have in common with my wife is we will both fill the space available to us. Like we are beta fish.
Oh yeah.
If I had a 10 bedroom house, I could make use of it.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so, that's what I would do. Mm-hmm. And then tons of secret passages and shit.
Oh, and you know, my cabin on that island is going to have secret passages.
Yeah. You'd have one that goes down. Like you'd have a Silent Hills Historical Society secret passage.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want a library. Mm-hmm. Like just comfy seats and like just tomes that are just for display that are open with a bookmark. So it just looks like I'm studying Eldritch shit. Mm-hmm. Even if I'm never reading those fucking books.
Even if it's just a Shadowrun spot.
It's literally book. Haunted House. Yeah. It's literally just Haunted House. I want to see what was real. I would do that. And it'd be great. Mm-hmm. You know, there'd be an element of solitude. I'm not nature driven mm-hmm. The same way you are in Malachi. So I wouldn't want that, but I am peace driven, you know, so mm-hmm. I would want to be away from the hustle and bustle.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you know, I wouldn't want to be I wouldn't have to worry about my house you know, being a target or what have you.
Yeah. No, I'd also have anti-aircraft guns. So.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Gotta keep those up there. Yeah. Man showers, security force 24/7.
You know. I've got this nice cabin. Got to protect it.
Yeah, I got to protect it.
Yeah. James writes, "Hey, Gary and Cole, in the March Dispatch episode, you very kindly shouted out the imminent birth of my daughter. I'm very happy to say that Lola is now 7 weeks old and doing great. Ooh. Currently, congratulations. Currently, she is still in the little alien stage of being a baby. She eats, she sleeps, she poops. And I find myself really looking forward to when I'll be able to introduce her to some of my major cultural loves. Studio Ghibli, REM, secondhand bookshops, board games. It's all on the menu for her to try in the future. I know you guys aren't necessarily interested in having kids, but as theoretical dads or simply very cool uncles, which things that you love would you be most excited to introduce to a youngin? Or have you already introduced the young folks in your life? Or what have you already introduced the young folks to in your life?" Yeah.
This is good and fun, I mm-hmm. think. I don't have kids and I have no brothers and sisters, but I have a very close set of friends who have kids. Their son, Ivan, is a budding little musician. Mm. So I've been gifting him secondhand musical stuff.
Oh, that rules.
And then just apologetically shrugging when I have no idea what to do for his little sister, mm-hmm. Who I love, but whose qualities include being a little girl, which means I know jack dick about anything she's into. But it's been really, really cool to encourage him and stuff. I gave him my old keyboard that has a sequencer in it so he can mm-hmm. learn about track recording and stuff like that. He writes little songs and stuff. Mm. Like, it's great. And it is very satisfying and fun to share that with him. He was into it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't see him enough to where I could like influence him.
Smother
directly.
Him with it. Yeah.
Yeah. I just happened to see an inroad and was like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Like, then, this feels good.
This will make it'll mean more to him than it will to me in this house, especially if it's secondhand. Right.
Yeah, totally. Like I'm looking, you know, I could an excuse to upgrade, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't done too much of this with my niece, really. I mostly have just been supportive. You know, she has much more in common with her dad for some weird reason.
Yeah. She's a real ooh-rah marine type.
But she likes tennis and athletic stuff. And that's
she's
good.
She's an outdoor kid. A sport kid.
Yeah. For my little sister, who's 11 years younger than me, that was a fun experience. Again, with like secondhand stuff, but also like, she showed interest in video games. So like, you know, I got her, you know, just like a secondhand Game Boy Advance SP, you know, when she was old enough to like, you know, appreciate it, you know, just gave her games and stuff for that. And even as she, you know, started like going to school and stuff, like she had audio video projects in school, and it's like, oh, well, here's like an old microphone, right?
Yeah.
You know, and just a place for when I upgrade something, a place for that old stuff to go, like that's cool.
Yeah. To, you Bottle know, it. Just, like yeah. it feels really good, and it feels really good to have it be used.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it feels really, it feels good to encourage
yeah.
a kid.
Yeah. So that was, you know, that's kind of my version of this, you know?
No. Yeah. And congratulations on Little Lola.
Little Lola. That's a very pretty name.
I think that's great. Yeah. Andy says, Andy K250 says, Scooter's coffee shops have been sprouting up around here like mushrooms. One of the items they sell is a turtle frappe. turtle is in the candy or ice cream made of fudge, caramel, and pecans. Anyway, the other day, I asked if I could have a turtle frappe with extra chocolate and caramel. When I got to the window, they were still working on it, and I overheard the person in the drive-thru say to their coworker, don't forget, he wants it with extra turtle sauce. For me, the words turtle sauce, taken out of context, instantly conjured various unpleasant images and flavors. Anywho, can you think of any terms of art where the otherwise mundane words you've overheard have formed into an unholy Neapolitan in your mind?
I think I talked about it on an Abject Suffering, but I was going through an Arby's drive-thru and I heard them again do the like talking into the shop kind of thing. Like, they said it to me because like, hey, you need to wait a little minute. We need to wait a minute. We're doing a beef refresh.
Oh, you told me about the beef. Yeah, beef. Yeah. Beef.
It might have been a beef renewal or something like that, but
yeah. We have to beef and re-beef.
Yeah, the re-beefing. That's the one that sticks out most right now.
That's a great one. I'm sure this has happened to me a lot. A standard one is nut meat or mouth parts are both things I don't like.
Nut meat is so good.
Yeah, nut meat's not my fave. Turtle sauce is great though. I guess horsey sauce is a classic that I've never liked.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, that's never cared for that one bit. Yeah,
is it four horses or made from horses? It's both. I don't. Yeah, that is. I don't know what a Scooter's coffee shop is, but a turtle frappe does sound good.
One more life question, you think?
Sure.
Yeah. Ben writes, I was recently on a trip from Cleveland to Kentucky and had to pass through coal country, coal with a K, which means going past the tourist trap known as Grandpa's Cheese Barn. That is a cheese barn.
Speaking of our last thing, there's a combination of words I don't like.
Cheese barn? Good.
That summons thumbs up. Various unpleasant images and flavors.
Grandpa's Cheese Barn is it is a known thing. There are lots of billboards, but yeah, I had to go past Grandpa's Cheese Barn. So my question is, have you ever gone there, or will it forever remain just a funny name on a roadside billboard?
So have you been to a Grandpa's Cheese Barn?
I've never been to Grandpa's Cheese Barn. Maybe my mom took me to maybe my mom took me to it at some point when we were over there. So like, it's in my neck of the woods, but that's in Ashland, which is about like 30 minutes to 20 minutes to the east of Mansfield in Ontario, where I grew up. So it wasn't like proximate. And if we were on a quest for cheese or fudge or any of the things that you would find in Grandpa's Cheese Bar, Amish country was right there, just in a slightly different direction.
Yeah.
And so we had places that we went in Amish country. But Grandpa's Cheese Barn and Sweetie's Jumbo Chocolates.
Ooh.
Boy, has not been a place. Yeah. No. Yeah,
I don't like any of that.
I haven't been to it. I wouldn't rule it out because I love going to an old timey style place that primarily sells jellies. You know, I will go and sit and peruse the jellies and sauces at a crafty place, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I can't find it right now, but it reminded me of when I first moved out here, me and my ex-wife kept seeing billboards for something called like, it's not the old spaghetti factory, which exists, but it was something called like the amazing pizza cliche or something like that. it might be the amazing pizza machine. It's the amazing pizza machine.
Instantly I would go.
Yeah, no, we went because we kept seeing signs for the amazing pizza machine, And it is a half carnival arcade laser tag pizzeria. Like it's a fake Chuck E. Cheese, but a bigger restaurant.
Okay.
Kind of thing.
It would have to be disappointing given the name.
I don't remember that much about it. Other than the fact that it was bigger than anything that it could ever be. It's so it's in Omaha. We passed through it in Omaha. It's in Omaha, Nebraska. So that was my vision version of that. Where I was like, an amazing pizza machine.
Look at look at the image on the about page that I just sent you.
Yeah. No, I've got it open.
Yeah. You see grandpa cutting a cheese that's bigger than his torso.
Yeah. Yeah. It's there's grandpa's cheese factory right there.
between Chicago and Milwaukee, there at least was, I don't know if it survived the pandemic, but there was a place called the Cheese Castle that I really wanted to go to. Like it was shaped like a medieval castle, but I guess they sold cheese there.
That stuff's great.
Yeah.
I love tourist trap, things like that. They're very fun. Moving on to media questions for a little bit. I'm going to get us started here with Randall. Randall says, have you guys heard about this crazy new custom Doom map called myhouse.wad? I've been really obsessed with it lately, watching blind playthroughs and explainer videos discussing the mechanics of it. If you haven't heard of it, I'd recommend trying it before looking it up or learning anything else about it. But if not, there's a couple of really good long videos on YouTube about it.
Gary told me about it and I streamed it and it owns.
Yeah. Yeah. I found out about this. It just got suggested to me on YouTube and I watched one of those like long explainer, like half let's play, half explainer videos of it. Mm-hmm. And it was so compelling and cool that like even my wife, who's not into Doom or anything, like sat down and was like interested in it.
No.
It looks awesome.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like something I need to play. Mm-hmm. That's just my own proclivities. Like I don't, the repetitive nature of like pushing
going
at
through
the boundary,
a similar space. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. To do that is not that interesting to me, but learning about it was fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a Herculean effort of absolute mastery of the engine and the form.
Yes.
You know, so love like, it. Even if the like subject matter and process of playing it is not interesting to you, I found it to be fascinating, even just in the hands, you know, but learning about it will be really satisfying if you have played Doom at all, and are familiar with kind of the limitations of what even the people who made that engine could do with it. Right.
There are companion videos that just go into the back end engine stuff of how it's done. And that stuff is really interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, very cool. Recommend to everybody listening to this. I don't necessarily think, you know, if it doesn't sound like your cup of tea, you know, that's fine not to play it, but I think it's very fun to learn about regardless. I'm very glad it exists.
Yeah. Shane's giving us a devil's bargain here.
Yeah.
You have the ability to give creative control over the Castlevania franchise over to Shigeru Miyamoto, but with a caveat, the control over the soundtrack will be given to Anthony Kiedis. Yeah. Do you accept?
So I ended up reading this in advance, like when it was just like seeing it on the Patreon. And this is a really, interesting journey. This question, because my instinct answer was like, sure. Because I don't care about Nine Inch Nails, but Trent Reznor did a good soundtrack for Quake. Maybe Anthony Kiedis would not suck. I don't know him as a musician. I just know him as a horrible lyricist and anti-charismatic weirdo.
Gary, you know him as a musician. You know his output.
I don't know him as what he composes, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Like I don't know how their process, right? Okay. Like I don't know Michael Stipe as a musician because he's primarily a lyricist, right? Mm-hmm. But then I was like, okay, so the easy answer or the non-intuitive first answer is yes. But then I looked at the first part of the question, which is Castlevania to Shigeru Miyamoto.
No.
And that's not something I want in the first place.
Nope.
You know, so I may be fine to see it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm kind of curious, but I don't think that plays to Miyamoto's strengths at all. So it just ends up being like a very tricky question. This is like a second edition D&D genie question to me.
do you accept? No. I mean, to me, like Castlevania through the lens of Miyamoto is interesting in the same way that like an AI generated image of Breaking Bad through the lens of Studio Ghibli is interesting.
It's kind
of like, oh yeah, that looks like Walt, but it's in that style. Okay, cool.
Huh. Now it's time to move on to something else. I don't have to play a whole game about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's also I think that the spirit of the question is to think of the premise as an unalloyed good.
Yes.
In which case, my first answer, the first part of the question, though, is hard for me to take as an unalloyed good, not just because of Miyamoto, but also I'm not that hungry for Castlevania to come back. Mm-hmm. You know, like I am fine with it being dead. There are so many Castlevania games. They're all really good. They're right there. You can play them. And there are spiritual successes. Yeah, there are spiritual successors as well. Mm-hmm. I don't need Castlevania to come back.
Yeah.
I don't need anything to come back.
It's let it die. Just, we did a whole episode about it.
Let it die. Yeah, I don't really care about a franchise continuing usually, mm-hmm. personally. Cinderelf says about media. When I was a kid, I watched a Norwegian movie that roughly translates to Chasing the Kidney Stone.
Oh, no.
In which a young boy gets magically shrunken down by his teddy bear to go inside his sleeping grandfather to fight an anthropomorphic kidney stone. One of the grandfather's red blood cells is the love interest.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's phenomenal. That's what's the weirdest movie incest. You saw as a kid? Oh, I, you're right. It's microbial incest.
The question is, what's the weirdest movie you saw as a child?
Yeah, okay. That's great, though. That's very good. I don't have anything that like stands out that well, because like my movies I saw when I was young are stock. You know, like I saw Return to Oz as a kid. That's mm-hmm. a really fucking weird and haunted movie. You know, Garbage Pail Kids,
mm-hmm.
disgusting, yeah. like just absolutely foul and disgusting movie. Howard mm-hmm. the Duck, disgusting foul movie. I saw a lot as a kid. You know,
yeah. The thing that haunted me forever was when I was a very little kid. Somebody as a gift gave me and my brother gave the house a VHS tape of The Little Mermaid. But it wasn't Disney's Little Mermaid.
Oh yeah.
Somebody got catfished, and I had to like go and look. It's actually like an anime that got Americanized, translated. Mm-hmm. Just like in I think in the like late 70s, and then it was reissued on VHS or whatever. I at one point knew what it was. So I was confused because it wasn't like the Little Mermaid I thought I knew. But also it was very faithful to the Hans Christian Andersen like fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like fucking grim and
German fairy tale ends predictably.
Right. Like, yeah. And so like, I don't know, I watched it once and then it was on the shelf, and every time I would see it, I'd be like, you know, because it was like a movie long version of the Large Marge scene from Pee-wee's Big Adventure phenomenal. To me. Yeah. That's great. I'm sure the movie is like, you know, boring as hell, but in my mind it kind of looms as just like, I was not ready for this. I was not braced for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Extra spooky because that's a good answer. Those off model Disney fast follows are great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lightning round.
Do you want to do a couple show questions?
Oh yeah, let's do a couple show questions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tamika writes, sorry if this has been asked before, but whatever happened to the skits that used to start off the WAF episodes? The Cid ones from the Final Fantasy VII series were surprisingly funny, and I like the Mysterious Stranger ones in the Fallout episodes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were mixed reception, but we did them for a long time anyway, because we liked them. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then I think that we just started doing too much to do them.
Yep.
And the big moment for me, when the first time I realized I felt like they had their time had passed, was when I realized how many times, and it wasn't like every time, you mm-hmm. know, there were ones I still think are funny, but there were enough times where I was like, ah, God, what do we need something for this? What do we do?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just wasn't, the inspiration wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's like, well, we could just do them if we're inspired, but like we do a lot of shows.
We
and
do.
It was labor intensive.
It was time intensive. Confidence.
The inspiration wouldn't come because we would be, you know, and for something that like roughly half, like the number, you know, again, I have no shame, right? It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. But the number of people who were like, this is a good show, except for that.
Yeah.
You know, was a little demoralizing. So, yeah. And there are ones that I absolutely think are dog shit too. Like they're not mm-hmm. totally wrong, you know, but there are also ones I think are good. There are a couple minutes grow mm-hmm. up. Is the other thing I kind of feel about it. Like, you know, it's not that big a deal. Let us have our fun. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't necessarily miss them.
Yeah. It felt like their time had come for any number of reasons, you know, just show changes over time. We change. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So I'm glad you like them though. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Will says, is the submittal form on the Watch Out for Fireballs page still checked regularly? With Patreon sponsors and other sources of suggestions, how often do website submittals reach consideration?
So this is important. So those do go to the email. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of a dick about it, which is we very clearly say in the Patreon prompt that this is a the submitting the questions is a reward for folks, you know. Mm-hmm. So like if you are a patron, you can see that post and respond to it. So mm-hmm. there is that, but also it's a certain amount of like, I'm sorry you didn't follow directions, and so many other people did. That like I don't want to let you hop to the front of the line because we kind of made it simple. So those are there and I see them, but they just don't get kind of carried over to other stuff.
There might be, I think that Will might be referring to suggest a game.
Yeah. I don't even know if that is still up. That goes to a form. Yeah. That goes to a form somewhere. Is the submittals form with Patreon sponsors and other sources of suggestions. Okay. Yeah. Well,
that's my guess because of Patreon sponsor.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know for sure. My guess is that, and the answer, at least on my end, is that like when I do see that stuff, it mm-hmm. kind of goes into the thought cabinet.
Yeah.
But a lot of times because we get a lot of executive produced episodes and now that we've given ourselves vanity picks, which is a decision I really like and mm-hmm. I don't want to go back on. A lot of times when we're filling in those holes, we have to be very tactical about length and genre.
Mm-hmm.
So the it's a little bit more narrow casted.
Yeah.
You know, it's less likely like, oh, on a whim, we're going to do this thing that was suggested. It's more like we need something that is a little breezy because we just did a very, very long open world game and then a novel.
Yeah.
You know, so now we need something quick and maybe mm-hmm. mechanics focused. It's more like we go needs first.
Yeah.
You know,
I didn't realize that forum was still up there. There's a lot about the web presence for the network that needs to be kind of overhauled. Those are captured, on a place, but it is not regularly reviewed. Yeah.
I got no problem with people suggesting things as long as our suggestions. I've done a couple and I've saved the threads of long, Twitter. Mm-hmm. Threads of just like, what are short games when we need to fill in a spot? Those get looked at. Those are all in the spreadsheet of stuff that we need to, you know, for when we're grasping mm-hmm. for something.
Yeah.
So apologies if you know, you put something in there and it felt inevitable that it would roll up. With the way that we do it now, it's more like we try to find the correct puzzle piece.
Yes.
For something.
Yeah. Let's see here. Do we want to do? Let's do Aaron.
This is fine. I can do this. I already told Will that it happened.
All right. Yeah. Aaron says, long-term discussion prompt. Why is Gary so unwilling to take 1 minute out of his life to watch Will's spoiler-free and funny Tears of the Kingdom video? He claims he wants to avoid FOMO since he's not playing the game yet, but I feel his FOMO should actually be about missing out on this video while the dozen or so Guppy listeners are talking about it and enjoying it. There are dozens of us, dozens. Not watching Will's video isn't a personality.
Very funny. I said this seriously to Will and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. It didn't take, so I'll say it seriously again. I can't play that yet. My wife's playing it. We have a physical mm-hmm. copy and doing work stuff. I'm just ducking out of all Tears of the Kingdom stuff. I don't uh-huh. want, it's none of my business until it is.
Yep.
And it's not that I think Will's not funny. Mm-hmm. I think Will is funny. It's not that I think that like whatever, you know, the slapstick that happens in that video won't be funny. I'm gonna look at it later.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just avoiding Tears of the Kingdom stuff. It's none of my business. I don't have space for it in my brain right now because mm-hmm. if I start giving it space, I'll start having feelings and it will cause me anxiety. Mm-hmm. It is a function of mental health like maintenance
mm-hmm.
more than anything. And I know that makes it sound like I'm chiding a joke with a serious answer. But it is, you know, lowercase mental health, but it is an anxiety management tool to make things that are not my business, not my business.
Yeah.
You know, stresses me out to mm-hmm. think about, like, it makes me feel literal human guilt.
Yeah.
Sometimes when it's like, I should be playing a thing and I'm not.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I should only feel that for work.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't need to feel that for just a video game that'll be there and 20 years just as well as it is now, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is the true answer, but it is very funny and it is not a personality. You're right.
I'm going to do another show question, but this kind of edges into lightning round as well.
Yep.
Ben asks, what are the odds of getting a WAF episode on Plague Tale Innocence? Indeterminate. I haven't played it. I understand that it's good. I also understand that it has problems. It's been on my list of things to possibly stream on Hexcrank, and I would only advocate for it if I played it and knew that it was going to be worth the squeeze.
Yeah, I've read about it and seems I have got no problems with it on concept, other than the fact that I think it is a mechanics light, narrative heavy game.
Yeah,
and we've been doing tons of those lately. Mm-hmm. I would like a break from those in a general sense. So next time I'm in the mood for one, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I got no particular animus against that game. Is mm-hmm. that the Bloobs? That's not the Bloobsters.
No, that's a different team. Okay. Different
Bloobsters.
Different. Yeah. Non-Bloobs.
Yeah, they spell and pronounce their names differently. Mm-hmm. Lucas, we're in the lightning round now. Lucas says, "Uh-oh, listenership is down, and the Patreon is hemorrhaging subscribers. This is a horrible way to find this out." Damn it, Lucas.
Why is everybody bringing us news?
Yeah, it's clear that you need to do something to save WAF, so you decide to bring in a sidekick nobody likes and doesn't fit on the show. What's your own personal scrappy do nightmare like, Will?
Yeah, Will. Yeah. Are you ready for episodes to be 7 hours long?
Yes. Yeah.
No, why is the Excite Bike expert? Why is the Excite Bike episode a two-parter? Yeah,
just a lot of weird power dynamics of it always being the shifting 2v1 fight where the matchups are continuously changing.
Yeah, which is really good. The times when we do it,
it is a sometimes treat. Yeah, I think. Yep. No, Will's not my real answer for that. I love Will and I love him as a game critic. And I've thought before, like, I don't know, maybe Cole gets canceled. Do I want to keep doing a podcast? Maybe I do it with Will. I thought about that like idly, you know, it would not be Will. I think it would be I remember if anyone listening to this, or if you, Cole, if you listen to the old Games for Windows, Live GFW Radio podcast.
I'm aware of the crew. I didn't listen to it at the time, but I have heard all of the principles on other stuff.
Yeah. It's a great show. You know, very good. But for the first kind of like quote unquote season of it, they had a guy named Darren on the show, who was a Darren Gladstone, I think maybe is his name. He's a old guard game journalist guy, but he was real like, hey, let's get hyped for news.
Uh-oh. You know,
I'm a podcaster. Like, he had that big energy, and it, you could hear it, and it's fucking makes your soul leave your body of him going like, I guess we got, Jeff Green, the sweetest person in the world, being like, I guess we got to go to the news. What do you got for us, Darren? And Darren going, all right, spinning around in his chair and then just talking about the same and nobody reacting, everyone feeling awkward. I think somebody who came in with big gamer news energy would kill us.
Yeah. Oh no, I mean, just to transfer that on, if we pulled somebody from the world of streaming or YouTube onto this, I mean, like, anybody who, just to fit in with the fiction of the question, like, oh no, we need to like boost our popularity, like getting somebody who is entirely from like the influencer world.
Yeah, I'm Gary, like, I'm cool, and I'm Markiplier. Yeah, and we're the game grumps.
And my understanding is Markiplier is like one of the better ones
he's fine. Yeah. The energies are just entirely different. Like, every time, when I explain this job to people, if they're not just doing the Tim Meadows, like, no, my video games ain't cool. Then they think I'm a streamer. I have to explain like, no, I'm way slower than that.
Yeah. No, like, it's much less interesting.
Calmer.
Yeah,
like it's much more of a calm energy is what we like to do. The fast face world of streaming we cannot do.
Yeah, we're a downer. We're not an upper. Yeah. If we brought an upper in, it would be it would completely wreck the vibe. No speedballs. No speedballs on WAF.
And there are probably some people who would like WAF to be more crossfaded, and would want there to be that energy, and that's okay. Yeah. We would have less fun. I think that would bleed through. Maybe we're wrong, but we'll never know.
Yeah, and we're going to crossfade it and using the drug thing. I'd rather get a hallucinogen in there than a speed.
Yeah. Let's get Professor LSD Trails to join us to talk about LSD Dream Simulator.
Yeah.
Even while we're talking about Excite Bike. Mm-hmm. That's why it's two hours long.
Yeah. Randall, this is a question for Gary. Short one. Favorite Noah Caldwell Gervais video?
Love them all. My all-time favorite, the one I've rewatched the most, is the one on Postal mm-hmm. hatred and weighing the value of asshole simulators.
Oh, yeah.
I think is the best intersection of talking about video games that don't get talked about for things other than like their emblematic kind of properties, mm-hmm. which is something I always want, while also integrating the social commentary of those really well. You know, mm-hmm. A pet peeve of mine in Games Crit, and specifically New Games Crit, is something like the horrible Hogwarts game comes out. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that has a lot of ethical and moral issues that are worth talking about. Mm-hmm. At the same time, that was made by hundreds of people, and there is a game in there mm-hmm. that I also am interested in. Like, not interested in, like, I want to play it, but interested in, like, I'd like to know about it.
Yes.
Right? Big shout out to Gita Jackson's review of which is mm-hmm. the best balance of that I've seen. It's like, yeah, this is problematic and shitty, but also what is it?
Yeah.
You know, and Noah's perfect at that. Like, he's, mm-hmm. One of the reasons why I admire him so much is that he does that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just read a poem about social issues when I read a piece of Games Crit. Mm-hmm. I think that's the best balance he does.
Yeah.
It's also educational because it's a set of games I'm never going to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, I get to learn about a weird corner of gaming that is just not for me.
Yeah. And I just don't watch long form video game YouTube stuff. I respect Noah Caldwell Gervais' work. It's mm-hmm. just not a place in my life for it.
Yeah. If you ever end up low on podcast mm-hmm. anymore, I don't watch any of those. I just put them on while I do chores and treat them as podcast, and they work mm-hmm. real well. Like, the idea being, you have to see the visual examples. Mm-hmm. Very rarely does that matter. It almost always feels like stock footage.
Yeah,
that's being put over. Like, every once in a while, there's a relevant example, but for the most part, you can just put them on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, makes sense.
Yeah. Cinderelf says, did you guys watch the new trailer for the Venture Brothers movie? If so, any thoughts? Yeah, I watched it.
I did not.
Yeah. Going in spoiler free.
It's not even like a matter of spoiler free. It's just, I know the boys, and every trailer is incredibly deceptively edited.
Yes.
I do not expect it to actually, like, all the stuff that's in there is going to be present. You know, it's material from there. The final product is probably not reflected in that at all, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There won't be straight putts. Yeah. I watched it. It looks like season 7 Venture Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it looks good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
So.
Same.
Yeah.
Doug writes, you're an ancient mad king.
Bad news does not stop. How do I have to find out about that from Elis?
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to keep bringing you this.
All these bearers of bad news. Damn.
Okay. You're an ancient mad king, mortally wounded by an ungrateful mob. Dying, you curse an object to bring death, misery, and perhaps the possibility of your resurrection. What object do you choose?
Oh, boy, I don't know.
You curse an object to bring death, misery, and perhaps the possibility of your... So, like, basically, like, the MacGuffin that the heroes of the campaign have to stop the bad guy from getting.
Yeah, yeah. Or like a one ring kind of thing. Like, you hold on to it and it brings all this death and misery, but it can fulfill the quest about bringing you back.
Yeah.
Because it is an ungrateful mob. You know, so they're not right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess if I I'm also ancient at this point.
Yes.
So if I existed now, it would be something that I used all the time. Like, maybe mm-hmm. like a back scratcher.
God damn it. I am holding a back scratcher right now, Gary. I am playing and fidgeting with a back scratcher.
Me too. I'm distracting Pocket from my cords with it. So maybe a back scratcher, I guess.
Maybe a back scratcher. Yeah.
We should get one of those ass to ass double back scratchers so we can scratch both our backs at PRGE.
Yeah. I mean, as far as like coolness factor goes, I've always liked the idea of like the cursed glasses, you know, the They Live thing. I think that'd be real cool.
That's a cool idea.
Yeah.
I don't have enough items with like totemic significance.
Yes.
You know, like I have stuff that I really value, but it's silly piddly shit.
Yeah. The black t-shirt of Mad King Ross.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which one?
Yeah. I got 10 of them.
Yeah.
So, So yeah, hard thing to answer. Back scratcher glasses, something quotidian. Yeah.
Oh. Close us out, or I'll close us out here with Chapel. Chapel says, as well-versed horror fans, what horror media has actually scared you the most?
Most of my life was watching Pet Sematary too young. Like the most recent thing that I can say, like, oh yeah, that is like, that scared me, you know, in a surprising way, was Hereditary.
Yeah. I was going to say Hereditary too. Like, yeah. Hereditary scares me a lot.
Yeah.
That really works on me. That might be the number one. Also, I find, I get more scared by games a lot of times than movies. You know, and get, there are games that I've had to nope out of. You know, so I don't know how scary they ultimately get. There's a Half-Life 1 mod called Afraid of Monsters that I bounced off of, but who knows if I'd bounce off it now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know?
Amnesia is scary, at parts that, you know, that maxes that out.
Yeah.
A couple points.
Only two games have made me need to leave the room. And, they are Amnesia, The Dark Descent, and Silent Hill 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and there's also different kinds of fear. We're well-versed enough horror fans to be insufferable about this question, where like the kind of fear matters. So, you know, the existential fear of Silent Hill 2, like, you know, is that, am I scared of that? Or am I just thinking about something that's depressing? So it is the, you know, what is the fine distinction between those two things?
When you say it like that, it takes all the magic out of it.
It is more just depressing to think about than scary, but that's a kind of scary, you know?
Yep.
That's a kind of horror. So those would probably be answers for me. Moving on to topic, we're not taking one from listeners. We had one queued up for a couple months now, and we're going to do it to coincide with the episode we just recorded about the Resident Evil 4 remake. But I want to talk about with you what we think makes a good basic enemy in a video game. The obvious impetus behind this is the absolute stud-like perception of the humble Ganado, who it remains fun to fight in any game, the remake, the original, in VR, the beginning of the game, the end of the game. Ganados, that is always a good time. You throw some Ganados in there, the party has started. Time for Ganados.
Yeah. So do we want to talk about, like, you know, kind of dial in specifically on what makes the Ganado so good and derive some principles from that, and then kind of talk about other examples that might match those?
I think so. And then other ways you can accomplish those same goals.
Yeah.
You know? Why are Ganados good? They're always threatening.
Always.
You know, not intensely threatening, but they're always, you can never ignore them.
Yeah.
You're never going to sweep through them. They're never slimes.
Right.
That can't hurt you, and you can kill them one hit, and they may as well be a speed bump.
Right.
They always demand at least a little bit of your attention.
Mm-hmm. They are not just there for you to inflict yourself upon them.
Yes.
You know, like, and that's why it's difficult, I think, to go back super far in, like, looking for, you know, something that is considered to be, like, you know, a good or a perfect enemy, because, you know, for a long time, enemies just kind of existed to be something to, you know, press your button and shoot. Right.
Yes.
And then they were gone. You know, so, like, you need to get into, I don't know, it feels like very recently they hit on kind of needing something a little bit more elaborate AI or behavior wise, right?
It's easier to talk about, I think, modern game design from this perspective, but I think there are old enemies that fulfill similar purposes.
I was in the hot tub at the Y earlier, and I thought up at least one example. I was really thinking about this.
That. Yeah. I was in the hot tub at the Y earlier.
I was in the hot tub. I sat down. I was like, I, you know, other than Ganados, like, it's really hard to think of examples. And I spent the whole time I was in there just focused on this problem. So,
everyone visualize that.
Yeah. It's not very pleasant.
Yeah. I think if we want, I mean, so let's finish honing in on Ganados and then talk about it. Cause I can think of a couple old examples and why they also fit that. So kind of being a persistent threat, I think matters, like never being obviated.
Yes.
And part of that is through scaling. Well, Ganados can become tougher through two different ways, either a different equip, equip loads, which they can take without breaking the game or breaking disbelief. Like, they're humanoid. They can wield weapons. You can give them weapons. They can wear armor. And then the other thing, and this is the thing that I think old games do when they have to solve this problem, which is numbers and mix-ups.
Yeah.
You know, so the Ganado, as a dungeon master's tool or whatever, can scale because I can introduce variants or just a shit ton of Ganados. As the player's power curve ups. And they can maintain that level of like perfect engagement.
Yeah, no, that's I think that is that is pretty important. And you can also make them, you know, you can scale them up by the addition of their second phase. Which is, you know, when the Plaga comes out.
Yeah,
and like that escalates, and that escalates as well, you know. And that is one of the best things that the remake did, which is, you know, add in that, you know, level zero Plaga kind of deal, which is the broken neck one. And it, each of them changes the behavior in a way. And that kind of leads into another kind of point, which is a variety of things that they can do to you. Like, they do not just kind of walk up and then swing. You know, they don't just kind of, you know, kind of like a serious Sam enemy try and find the shortest path to you and then run in. You know, there are any number of ways that they can articulate.
You know, so that kind of a variety of verbs. Like, certainly helps, but not too wide a variety of verbs. You know, you don't want it to be a Dark Souls boss. You know, to be this kind of thing. Weirdly enough, like, I also think Hollows are a good basic enemy.
That's on my list.
For the same reason Ganados are. Like, they scale up diegetically. Numbers will change them, and variants of them will change the mix-ups. You can get a really great example of that. Something that is, you know, really, really cool that I maybe, you know, appreciate more now than I did when I was playing it, is the Crystal Hollows in the Duke's Archives in Dark Souls 1. Have different verb sets, different resistances and everything, but the same basic move, or not different verb sets, different power levels, different equip loads, but they're familiar enough to where your past knowledge still works. It's not just a whole new thing.
That's I think that's important as well. Another thing, I think this is related to the variety, but I think it goes hand in hand as well. The enemy itself needs to use the environment and the systems well. Like, they need to be, they need to kind of be designed for each other, is what it feels like. And the Ganado, you know, is, you know, the Ganado and the spaces are designed around each other. They're adaptive like you are, and they force you, you know, to adapt, to change to them. You have the, you know, the ones that, they have the capability to attack at range, right? They will use cover. They will try to get high ground. They will bring ladders and try and come in different ways. Integrated. There we go.
Well, and it's also, they're integrated, and there's an element of like kind of mirroring to it too. Like, they can do the same things you can do, which is not always necessary, but can sometimes be very good. You know, and can lead to good results in this. I think that a really good basic enemy should teach you stuff about how to play the game. You know, game design essay 101 thing, when people talk about Mario Brothers 1-1, you know, and the mushrooms walking towards you and teaching you to jump. You know, that was really good on that scale. Now that's kind of built into our gamer DNA to know that. But at the time, like, that was cool. That taught you something. The Ganados also teach you. Ganados and Hollows, like, pretty interchangeable. They're very similar enemies, I think. About positioning, about spacing, about not being surrounded, you know, crowd control, things like that. They're not so tough that you have to square up and one-on-one them, but they, you cannot let them get the better of you. It is a constant slow burn problem. That you have.
And, you know, the Ganados do something that is, I think, related to that, you know, teaching you something. I think that the, I think that the Ganados, they say something really basic about what Resident Evil 4 is, you know, which is, this is not a zombie. This is, you know, a more action focused thing where you are dealing with something that can do more than grab you and bite.
it teaches you that, and it teaches you something very specific about your verbs by having weak points and encouraging you to aim, which is the innovation Resident Evil 4 gave.
That's what it is. They have these weak points, and they react in very predictable ways. They're telling you about what this game is and how it is different than the previous one. Like this is this is going to express to you, because it is the most common thing that you're going to see, what this is about. It has something to do with like the mechanical thesis of this.
Yeah, a really good example of a enemy that does that, even if it's not a game I'm as wild about as most people. Dead Space. Mm-hmm. The Dead Space, the first necromorphs you run into do a great job of teaching you what type of game it is.
Yeah.
That and very unlikely graffiti.
They didn't have a single bucket of paint on this fucking ship.
Yeah. And they just shoot, cut off their limbs. It is so dumb. Yeah. But yeah, it is. They do a really good job of that.
Yeah.
What are some other very, very good basic enemies you can think of that we can extrapolate some basic enemy qualities?
Yeah. So the Hollow Soldiers are there. That was going to be kind of like my main one from like, you know, modern stuff. I want to go back in time, actually, for this one. Okay. And
maybe back in the past.
Yeah. To play a good game that does not suck ass. No. The Stalfos in Zelda 2.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, in Zelda 2 specifically. Yeah.
Yes, in Zelda 2 specifically. It satisfies all of these by being an enemy that is entirely about the sword fighting system. Like other enemies, the Octoroks or whatever, like, you gotta like dodge their projectiles and get close and shoot them, just like, and kill them, just like you would have, like you would do in Zelda 1. Zelda 2 is entirely different because it is this side-scrolling perspective, and you can duck. Whether or not you're attacking, like, you have to learn and engage with the sword fighting in this all throughout, right? And there are there are variants that they add in as they go, and ultimately it culminates in the Shadow Link, right? Which is the sword fighting kind of like final exam, you know. Yeah,
I'm not splitting hairs around this, but just as for the sake of discussion, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what's interesting about a thing in terms of games changing is that I think in Zelda 2, those enemies are not really positioned as basic enemies. Mm-hmm. Like, they're positioned as kind of like a Black Knight style enemy. Yeah. Like, there are literal knights that pop up too, but they're a enemy that only really appears in dungeons. They're kind of semi-climactic encounters, but to me that talks about more of how Zelda and games of that era and games developed by Nintendo have such, to me to a fault, but taste very such a gentle curve.
Yeah,
you know, like the version of contrast Zelda 2 with how quickly Infernax has people who can do stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, and how common they are. Like Zelda 2 wants to onboard you so gently that I think that its basic enemies are those like Octoroks and slimes and shit.
Yeah,
and those weird guys with the mustaches, the otter guys who walk at you. Moblins. But in a better version of the game, and depending on how you stretch it, the Stalfos is the first enemy that reaches modern basic enemy standards.
I just, you know, the Stalfos just live so large in my head with it that I guess I'm rounding up and making them more common.
Yeah,
you know, but
nothing wrong with that. Like, it is an archetype that's in the game. It says more about games of that era that developer, I think, than it does
And I was reaching back pretty far. Like, I just wanted to find something that was prior to my other example, because I had four total.
My old example that I think about, and this is, it's still on that old, scale. Mm-hmm. I think that, Goombas, not a good basic enemy. Mm-hmm. Koopas, I think, are good at basic enemies.
Oh yeah. That's
Koopas, scale well. So when they fly, they both fly and jump in those arcs, which does interesting area denial stuff. And then the idea that once you kill them, they present a problem and a solution.
Oh yeah.
At the same time, like, you'll either kick this thing and create a hazard zone that you are likely to die in, or you can kick it and weaponize it. I think is a touch of future versatility and scaling that modern enemies do. You know, and it's rare, because I don't think, you know, I love Mario, you know, don't, I'm not, I got my bona fides. Love Mario. But I don't think that Mario 1, in terms of this specific aspect of game design, is any great shakes.
Yeah.
I think that Lakitos are more annoying than anything. Those Bowser boss fights are stupid. You know, it's a good game, but I don't think it's does anything too noteworthy. But I think the Koopa Troopa is really good.
Yeah. No, Koopa Troopa is great.
Yeah. He does a really good, and you know, the same kind of thing, especially once you go on to like Yoshi's Island, like Shy Guys are similar. They scale and have different variants. They sometimes shoot, you know, and everything in Yoshi's Island is a weapon as well. That's more about the verb set, but I think you could edge them in there as well.
Yeah. Yeah. This is not one that came up in my, it's not one that came up in my thinking in the tub. But I'm going to throw it in here. The imps from Doom.
Okay.
You know, in terms of like, you end up getting the soldiers who have hit scan or whatever, but like, that is not what Doom is about.
I would say the soldiers with hit scan are bad basic enemies.
Oh yeah. They're terrible.
Hit scan is not very good in Doom. And there's a reason why boomer shooters that have come out since then basically very, very rarely have hit scan enemies.
Yeah.
They're serious threats, whereas almost everything else is projectile because that is more fun.
Yes. And then the hit scan enemies just kind of slowly go away, you know, as you get further and further into hell, which I think is a good thing. The imp, you know, like most enemies operate on the principle of the imp in Doom. The imp as an introduction, to the fact that this is, you know, basically the difference between hit scan and projectile and teaching you how you need to move, in this, feels good to me. Yeah. I would say imp also satisfies this.
Imps are real good. They have a lot of these common things, which are, you know, you cannot ignore them. They scale up in numbers to cause a threat, and they create like interesting tactical situations. The last example, and we can decide when we've come with enough examples to express this idea, is a little bit of a cheat, but I'm gonna do it anyway.
Okay.
The only enemy group that is in every biome in Darkest Dungeon are the cultists.
Okay.
And they're excellent at this.
Okay.
Maintain a threat. They teach you things. The standard cultist loadout is two of the guys with the Wolverine claws and two of the chanters, the ladies with the staffs. That is teaching you about front rank, back rank, damage versus stress, damage over time, and like enemy prioritization. And they scale perfectly. They're always interesting to fight. Like, it's never like, oh shit, I just ran into these guys, tappa tappa.
Yeah.
They're a problem. And they're an interesting problem. And it's the closest thing that game has to a basic enemy, because each biome has its own set.
Yeah, its own thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, the cultists, I think, in Darkest Dungeon are excellent basic enemies.
Yeah. Based on what I can remember, I can agree. My last example of this is the Combine Soldiers from Half-Life 2.
That's a great answer. Yeah.
Yeah. It almost feels like basic. It feels like it came with the world, but you know,
if we wanted to go a little bit further back too, I would say the military from Half-Life 1 is really excellent.
Yeah. The military from Half-Life 1, I thought about that. Like, the AI in that is impressive. I feel like they're just a little bit too limited in what they can do.
They're also introduced a little later.
To a little bit too late to be like a basic enemy. I think like basic enemy in Half-Life 1 would be zombies, you know?
Yeah. We're fine, but nothing, no great shakes. Like, there's a thing that's like, something can be adequate and that's fine.
Yes.
You know, for this, like, there's something, one thing, and this is not me just doing my business here. I don't think a lot of times, traditional turn-based role-playing games do a good job with this, because what is interesting about a slime later, like, they do variants. There's like metal slime and stuff every once in a while, but anytime you go back to the beginning, you're still going to run into slimes, and there's no tactical consideration. There's nothing you can do. It's not on the same kind of level as that.
Yeah. Just in terms of like variety of things that they can do, the Combine Soldiers, they don't just have grenades or whatever, but I think manhacks are a big part of that as well. You know, just that is something that can always come along to flush you out, which I think is more interesting than a grenade because it is a persistent threat that will follow you.
Yeah.
And changes prioritization more than a grenade does. It feels like they're integrated with the both the world and the systems. Like they're going to use cover. They're going to work together. They're going to coordinate, even if you cannot understand what they're saying when they're doing it. Some of the times because of the voice filter that's going on, you know. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it feels like they were designed for the spaces that they're put in.
Yeah. Yeah. All very good basic enemies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think. And I think we've hopefully honed in a little bit on what makes a good one and then what makes a fine one. Can you think of bad? Like not bad, like boring. You know, like an Octorok is boring. But like a what's a bad basic enemy?
That's tough.
I know.
It's tough to say one that's bad and not boring. Because like the example that I would give, and I don't even know if I fully believe this, but I think that there is a certain annoyance around like the basic invisible enemies in Killer 7. The problem in that is, you know, okay, so they're invisible, you have to expose them, and then you have to, you know, aim at the right thing and shoot it. The problem is that is more of a critique of the system of that game itself, more than it is, you know, my problem with like that particular enemy as it goes. It even follows like a lot of the same rules. Like they elaborate on them. They get more capabilities as they go on. They're always a threat. It might even just come down to they come at you, explode. And if they don't immediately kill you, they go pretty far towards it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know?
To do a bad example, and part of this is that they're boring, but there's a little writer thing to it as well. And also to balance the scales and talk some shit about a CRPG. In the Infinity Engine games, the D&D based ones, it is silly that there are kobolds, goblins, and orcs. It is obviously, you know, the boring is the problem.
Yeah.
But there's something, you know, we talk about scalability, right? A Ganado would not be good if a Ganado was treated as a totally different counter when it got 5% tougher, which is what it feels like with all of the demi-human crew of a lot of old D&D games. Like it's just too gradual of an increase. You do not engage in a different way with an orc than you do with a goblin in Baldur's Gate.
Yeah.
That is a bummer.
Yeah. That's a good example.
Yeah. 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 So topic we've had burning a hole in our pocket for a couple months.
Nice. That's probably the most prep I've done for one of the topics, actually.
It's a hey. Let's read some responses.
Let's do. We had 4 episodes this month, so we've got a lot of responses. So we're going to jump right into it. People really wrote in about 7 out of 10 games.
Nice.
Get started here with Steven, who says, absolutely love this episode. Thank you. Just wanted to say how good it was and how much I would enjoy 7 out of 10 games becoming a regular feature on the show. I think I could even go as low as 5 out of 10 games that people like. You know, let the real sickos have a voice.
The sickos have enough power. I would not cross out doing this again. If we have a Duckfest or a live show or something like that, it was fun. And there's a lot of examples we can think of. Like doing the episode was very fun and made me think of more things. Mm-hmm. It is to me a very interesting topic.
And I love Bob, but having a different third as well. Yeah. Would change up the dynamic.
This is the perfect topic to have a third.
Yeah.
On like sometimes people will be like, why don't you have more people on WAF? And the answer is there's a rhythm that we have. And a big portion of it is us going beat by beat through the game, which would bore other people and interrupt our rhythm.
Yes.
Something like this that is a topic-based thing, it is a lot easier to have guests, and it's probably something we're going to try to do in the future for live shows and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Kevin says, Lost Planet, the first one is easily my favorite 7 out of 10 game. It's a strange Capcom shooter from the 360 days that I loved on every level. The campaign was fun, and so was the multiplayer. The shooting is slow and clunky, but it'll always have a special place in my heart. I barely played games in the 360 era. Mm-hmm. I've talked about that before. I miss so much from that zone. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what Lost Planet is. I've heard the name, but I couldn't point out a screenshot of it.
You're shooting it. You're fighting big monsters on like an Arctic world kind of thing. It's a little like horror-esque, but not really. Okay. It's like a sci-fi shooter kind of deal. I've never played it. I just know it by, you know, reputation and stuff. And Lost Planet seems like a good good example of that. I mean, similarly from Capcom at the time, Dead Rising as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
Even though I think that has bigger swings for sure. Like we talked about the different kinds of 7 out of 10s.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't played Lost Planet, but just from the description, it seems like a solid thing as opposed to big highs and low lows or big esoterica, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is why I would call Dead Rising.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, they made three of those fuckers.
They did.
Oh.
Zane writes, I want to make the case that Earthbound is a 7 out of 10 game if you played it when it came out. No game facts, no schoolyard shared knowledge, no save states, no fast button. A unique, magical story with tons of wit and charm on one hand, but an obtuse, grindy game with difficulty spikes and tons of friction on the other.
I can buy it.
Yep. No, I feel like it very much has the spirit of a 7 out of 10.
Yeah. It's it's the high highs, low lows, 7 out of 10. Mm-hmm. Like when people remember Earthbound, they're not remembering that fucking sewer.
Nope.
I'll tell you that much. Like that was hell to get through. That was really annoying. And you had to do it twice. It sucks. It's real bad. Never should have been designed that way. Mm-hmm. But the things are special. It's also a different way that like 7 out of 10s can live in your memory, where like the natural centrifuge that comes where you just remember the good parts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times a 7 out of 10 really benefits from that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I think
it does. And Earthbound also has has something going for it, which is it is a humble product that is also quirky. You know, that is a real hallmark of this stripe of game.
Yeah, it's the kind of 7 out of 10 that you can understand why people call it a 10 out of 10.
Yes.
You know, Bibby says, and I bet my sweet. Maybe on this one, says, as a certified Snatcher and Killer 7 enjoyer, my favorite games are probably closer to 5 out of 10s. But for 7s, I would submit Beatdown Fist of Vengeance for PS2 from, you guessed it, Kavya. A 3D beat-em-up, it's the good version of Final Fight Streetwise, utterly absurd without the gross chauvinistic tone, a small open world to explore, and full of genderless and a full genderless dress-up system, allowing you to play a mean lady in a suave suit or a big angry Australian man in a miniskirt and heels. The PS2 7 out of 10 collection would be remiss without it.
I had no idea that Beatdown Fist of Vengeance exists. Kavya, for people who are not aware of that by name, that's like the Drakengard studio.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've heard of this game, but I've never played it.
Yeah.
The idea of a good version of Final Fight Streetwise mm-hmm. makes sense to me as shorthand.
Yeah.
You know, Final Fight Streetwise being pretty excruciating. as a Final Fight fan who went in, I was like, I wonder how they'll do this. And just like,
are you a Final Fight fan?
I was as a kid. Like when this came out, I liked Final Fight. I don't like, you know, now it's like, it's kind of funny. The mayor is, you know, like washboarding dudes and shit. Like that's kind of funny, but like it's not fun to play, I don't think.
I know you meant to say waterboarding, but I'm just picturing like the mayor taking somebody's head. What
I meant what did I actually say?
You said washboarding.
Yeah, his washboard abs. He jumps up and ab slams people.
Oh, okay.
And he washboards them.
I've not heard washboarding as
before I said it
as a verb.
Me either.
Sorry,
like, it just made sense in my head.
You know, language to that communication. I think you fell a little bit short on that one.
Yeah, perhaps.
Mark writes, my favorite game that is 7 out of 10 to its core is Dragon's Dogma. I'm a sucker for generic wizard fantasy, so a game that is like a mix between Devil May Cry and Monster Hunt, but with wizards is like catnip to me. The actual gameplay is great. Every class feels unique and is fun to play. The pawn system can give you a huge amount of control over your party without much time spent actively managing them. The DLC island is excellent all around. Unfortunately, there are holes where missing content should go, core mechanics that are completely opaque and never explained, and they play the credits after about completing about 2/3 of the story. It's a game that could have been a 9 out of 10, but was cut short, and I'm really hoping the sequel doesn't get the same treatment.
That 7 out of 10 is where I'd put Dragon Dogma as well.
Mm-hmm.
A game that I like. And that I liked more before I found out that it was so many people's absolute reason for living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not being contrarian, but just very surprised. Like, I am not seeing the same stuff that Austin Walker sees in this game.
Yes.
You know, I respect him a lot as a critic. I don't get it. Mm-hmm. It's not the same game I played.
Yeah.
You know, I played a fun 7 out of 10 that would not have engendered a lot of excitement for the sequel.
Mm-hmm.
To me, just kind of like, oh, that was good. That was fun. Mm-hmm. I liked it. So I'm 100% with you. Weirdly enough, the biggest thing for me that fucks it up is I think the story and dialogue is excruciatingly bad.
Yeah.
Some of the worst in class. But it definitely ends up being a high, low, lows kind of thing.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll cover it at some point.
Mm-hmm. It seems inevitable. Yeah.
Yeah. It's begging for it. Yeah. Moving on to responses about Infernax, Gordon says, I picked this up entirely as a play along with WoF, and I gotta say, this game is a miracle. After bloodily smashing my way through half the game, I was getting pretty confused though. Why on earth aren't we discussing this masterpiece in the same breath as Shovel Knight? Then I hit the castle with repeated tricky platforming with one hit kill bottomless pits, and it was the biggest shitting the bed since Zen. Luckily, the casual mode has more than fixed this, making replaying it with the different characters a joy. I'd like to take a moment to appreciate the genius move of making the bosses easy. They get in, make an impact, then explode in gore before the simplicity of the combat wears out its welcome.
Yeah.
The bosses are real pattern-based. Like, it's, I think by like NES standards, they would be hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they don't, they're like, they adhere to rules more than a lot of NES bosses do.
Yeah.
There's less randomness or things coming in at weird angles. Think about like Death in Castlevania.
Yeah.
You know, which is a really, really hard boss and does work in patterns. It's mm-hmm. just some of the patterns are things you can't answer.
Right.
You know, Infernax, one of the miracles of Infernax is that it's committed to presenting you entirely with problems that the player has a verb set to answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No notes.
Yeah, no notes. Agree.
Micah writes, as you explore the world of Infernax, you encounter obstacles you cannot get through, over or across. You have to earn movement abilities that tie to melee attacks. It's just like Guacamelee. And like in Guacamelee, you earn those new attacks by completing challenges like clearing dungeons and 8-bit Metroidvania. Further out on the edges of the map, there are even places where you need to chain your movement slash attack abilities together. There will be a pit with a wall suspended over it. Attached right to the other side of the wall, there will be a platform. So do a dash jump and then a leap in midair, right? Nope. You can't chain your attack slash movement abilities. Instead, you have to notice that there is a post stuck in a rock up on that platform. Except it's not a post, it's a lever. And to pull that lever, you need to buy a spell that has nothing to do with melee attacks, movement, or pulling levers. P.S. Also, you take contact damage from the bosses while they spend 75% of each fight being invulnerable to your attacks. And all the roofs are lopsided. The environmental art looks like it was done by a child using MS Paint, in contrast to the character portraits and boss sprites, which are fantastic.
I had a different experience than a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that feeling of not being able to chain your attacks felt fine. That felt mm-hmm. like Castlevania Delay.
No.
To me, the post read as levers.
Yeah.
To me, part maybe I might have been primed because the description for the bird spell says it's attracted to shiny objects, and then they have like a little glint.
Well, it even says it'll pull levers or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
So, yeah. I think that I might have gotten primed for it.
Yeah.
I have heard some people who don't like the contrast in the art styles. Like they, mm-hmm. but I've heard it both ways. I've heard people who love the boss portraits and then just, you know, like Micah here and dislike the town and general graphics. I've also heard people who think that the boss portraits stand out too much, like in Clangs. Yeah. To me, none of that stuff bugged me.
Yeah.
You know,
if they were to do the world art at the level of detail that is present in the portraits, I think it would fuck up the scale of what they're doing.
Yeah.
You would end up with stuff that is like way too big in order to show that kind of detail. Yeah. And then I think that sacrifices some of the NES-ness of it. And also I don't like platformers where the people and things are too big.
Yeah.
I don't want Shadow of the Beast.
Yeah. You'd have to increase the resolution and it would give up all the NES-ness.
Yeah.
Of it. It's interesting the comparison tier two. So this is probably just a difference in gamer types. Like I don't like Guacamelee.
Mm-hmm.
I played it at the time and thought it was okay, and then got to a point that was annoying, and then tried the second one, which is just a meme game, and got turned off and uninstalled it, never went back.
Yeah.
So to me, that was not like something to compare to.
Yeah.
But that's why we do these. Mm-hmm. Andrew says, I played through Infernax on co-op with a friend, and if I hadn't known it was an update, I would have assumed it was designed to be played that way. Serval's equipment is well-designed for fun, coordinated play. My buddy could put up a big shield while I went on the attack or fire crossbow bolts at a distant target while I banished zombies approaching him. While I wouldn't blame anyone for turning on casual mode, I will say that playing co-op classic sort of nets you an extra heart by default and makes for a great bonding experience. Finally, making it to safely back from a particularly difficult dungeon shuttle run after multiple attempts led to some incredible high fives. Our canonical playthrough had us portraying morally complex characters who refuse to burn down one village but randomly decide to flood another. We'll probably look up the ways to do a good and evil playthrough now and try out the other characters. Jesu de Seoul, Japan, but Quebec has taken the classic NES crown. I'm sure I mispronounced that.
Je suis désolé.
Ah.
I am sad, Japan. Yes.
Ah. Great, Andrew. Good job. way to put on the big boy pants there, Bubby. I know Andrew. I can make fun of him. The hardcore mode with co-op makes sense because if somebody dies, it's not instant death.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can bring them back with a heart.
Yeah.
So I can imagine how that would change everything for that. Like the hardcore mode, the problem is instant death.
Yes.
Getting rid of that is the only thing that casual mode does, or the main thing that casual mode does. Mm-hmm. Almost the only thing, and is definitely the most welcome change.
Mm-hmm. Losing the checkpoints would be a bit of a bummer. If the worst were to happen, but
it's less big of a bummer than the instant death. I think that's the main thing I turned on casual mode for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, but I was happy to hear that the co-op worked well.
It looks great.
Yeah. Well,
next time Derek visits, maybe we'll play.
Ooh, neat. William writes, Infernax is a great argument for accessibility / difficulty options in video games. Personally, I typically play on normal and have never really messed with Celeste style hypergranular difficulty options. Typically, the standard experience is a good one for me. But in this case, I was glad that the devs said the experience that we envisioned is not necessarily the one everybody is going to want, and we support you. After dying 7 or 8 times in the first dungeon, wondering when I would see a checkpoint, I decided, no thank you, and turned on casual mode, and I was much better for it. I actually wish the difficulty options would have been a bit more granular. As the game went on, I felt like I didn't really need that extra life or the extra experience, but the bonus checkpoints were huge. Absolutely no way I was finishing the game without them.
It would have been cool if you could turn those on individually.
Yeah.
You know, it's it has other cheats kind of things you can add.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, but giving you control, like something we got that question here about Noah Caldwell Gervais earlier. I'm re-listening to the videos he did on Bloodborne, Sekiro, and Elden Ring, just because I'm on a podcast I want to listen to. And despite the fact that he's a lot warmer on Sekiro than I am, he has this great bit about how, you know, bringing falseness to the argument that a player should not be able to control difficulty because Sekiro has all these ways to increase it. You know, like you can have your charm taken away. You can go ring the demon bell, and it is just chauvinistic and dumb to think that I trust people who find this too easy to make it harder. I don't trust people who find it too hard to make it easier.
No,
that is an arbitrary and bullshit line that I would eliminate from the gamer race if I could.
Yes,
you know, it's gross. It is just, you know, a bad comment waiting to be stepped in.
Yeah.
Whenever anybody gets mad about that. And I really, really love that Infernax doesn't do that shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Abram says, Infernax is a top tier game for me. I thought I would have friction with the dungeons and limited lives, but I ended up loving it, even on classic mode. The first time in a dungeon became exploratory delves to plot my route and find key items, follow up shuttle runs, secured items with perilous returns to hit the save point. My experience was of an old school TTRPG dungeon delve where you gauged caution against the greed of going deeper. Infernax is a potato chip game for me. It's a comfort food, and after having one, I want more. One more run, one more minute, one more dungeon. I beat this game 8 times now, 4 on Game Pass and 4 on my Switch. Not only is this a potato chip game, but after every run, they give you a coupon for a bag of a new flavor.
Oh, that's pretty good. I like that as a metaphor.
I like that little metaphor. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well put.
Mm-hmm. And 8 times.
Yeah,
I could see it. I mean, what, that's got to be, you know, 40 hours or something. That's not.
At the very least, I have a bad ending playthrough in me at some point.
Yeah. 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 I want to say, I mean, I probably have a Maxim gun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could probably both. Yeah. So probably three, but probably not more than three, but maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
You know? Yeah. I played through Shovel Knight a few times. Like, true. On a long enough timeline, I get nostalgic for this kind of thing.
Yeah. I get nostalgic for good games.
Yeah. We used to have Hope, Cash, and Reddick.
Yeah. You mean Lance Reddick?
Yeah. Okay. We used to have Lances, Hope, and Cash. You know?
Oh. Do you want to do the thing where we push Pentiment responses to after the admin if people want to nope out? Because there are some comments with spoiler stuff. It's so story heavy.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's read Resident Evil 4 Remake responses.
Let's do. We have Jared writing, this game masterfully showed me the things I loved growing up and subverted my expectations just enough to keep things interesting. Remove Leon and Luisa's creepy sexism. Great. Flip a familiar section 180 degrees. Heck yes. Add excellent new encounters like the wine cellar and the Bella sisters. Even better. But best of all, RE4 Remake made me grin like an idiot while simultaneously scaring the shit out of me. The double Garrodar fight was delightfully frightening, and the new Marathon Sprinter Regenerators chased me around the first corridor for a solid 5 minutes. Capcom made me nostalgic and surprised throughout, and I'm happy to have had the opportunity to experience it again.
Yeah. No notes.
What section was flipped 180?
I imagine part of the castle.
Yeah.
You know, one of the castle rooms that that's referring to. Yeah. The whole time I was playing Resident Evil 4 Remake, I was just like, oh, this is just pure joy.
Yeah.
You know, like this is a gaming experience without complication in the best way. And when I say complication, I don't mean the game isn't complicated. I meant my joy was not complicated. I wasn't sitting around thinking of ways I needed it to be better. Or thinking about what else I could be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fully immersed. It's, yeah, beautiful little game.
Love it.
Jake says, one of the things I love about the original RE4 is that it has such a specific tone and vibe to it. Leon is such a smug little shit, complimentary, and the camp really works for me. Going into RE4 Remake, my main hope was that they were able to capture this vibe, and for me, they didn't. I feel like they wanted to focus more on the horror and make it feel more contemporary with the other remakes and modern sequels. This led to a watering down of Leon, who still makes the same lines, but doesn't hit the same way as it used to. RE4 Remake is still an incredible game and really fixes the island portion for me, but as a complete experience, it doesn't measure up to the original for me. But hey, I am overjoyed to have both versions of the game out there. It's, for me, a matter of degrees, right? Like, we talked about this in the episode, but like, Leon is less stupid. It is less camp. It's not no camp, which would have been the bridge too far for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like, if that makes any sense.
And, you know, a matter of degrees is a good way to put it. And also, I mean, that conclusion, overjoyed to have both out there. Like, that is the conclusion to draw.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the degree of camp is going to definitely vary from person to person. Mm-hmm. I really want, I keep talking about Noah fucking Calderwell Gervais. he did every Resident Evil game video that's like 7.5 hours long. and did not, the tone switch stuff in Resident Evil 4 didn't work for him.
Oh.
You know, he played it with the whole series, played them in a weird order and stuff. And he, but I would love to see if this fixes that for him.
Oh yeah.
Like if that tamping down of the camp does that, you know, makes it more up his alley.
So, yeah, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He also correctly identifies as the weird fulcrum from which Resident Evil starts, like them setting themselves up for another stagnancy right in Resident Evil 4, which is pretty prescient. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, oh, that is what happened. Cause it's not that long a line to like six and dumb conspiracy CGI conspiracy movies about Tricell.
Fuck, man, they went right from 4, which is, you know, kind of its own standalone thing, right back to 5, which is huge globe spanning, you know, threat, total military stuff, right?
Saturation.
Yeah. But then also like right back into the lore snarl, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm a fan of the lore snarl. Fucking give that to me. I'm a piggy. I'm a sicko. Nom, 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 nom.
I,
but
yeah, I for in a lol, this sucks. I love it. mm-hmm. way. If somebody's like, oh, this is Blue Umbrella, like that will make me laugh. Mm-hmm. But I do like Resident Evil more without it. Like Resident Evil 7 was so much better before they started tying it into everything.
I'm sick. Yeah. Oh, give me that. Oh, tell me where the Umbrella logo came from.
It's just, I don't want it to turn into, you know, big steak and small beef going around solving world conspiracies.
Oh man. Tell me what Spencer did.
Yeah. I just love hearing about Spencer.
Oh gosh. But yeah, they kind of fell right back into something, you know, one of the major elements of the stagnation, which was the lore snarl. Yeah.
Yeah. What does Mike say?
Mike says, longtime listener, first time writer. During the pandemic, I've been playing through the mainline Resident Evils, including my only playthrough of Zero. That's one too many. and I'm wrapping it up with 5 and 6. I decided to play the original RE4 for the first time since the GameCube, days before the remake came out. I finished it, but I bounce off of the controls hard. So I'm interested to hear why Gary thinks the remake doesn't obviate the original. That being said, my playthrough of the original spawned the only piece of headcanon I care to hold on to. I was at the fortress section when Mike came out of nowhere to wreck shit. Then it hit me. What if Mike isn't the helicopter pilot? What if Mike is a sentient helicopter? What if Mike is a sentient helicopter come to mow down humanity's enemies? I couldn't stop laughing during the remake because I think the new voice fits the theory better than the voice in the original. Unfortunately, the developers gave the pilot more screen time in the remake, but hey, everything that happened after Leon gets injected could be a hallucination, right?
That's great. That makes me want like a Resident Evil fighting game where Mike is in the helicopter.
Or it's just like that. It's like that One Punch Man fighting game where you can't play as One Punch Man, but like he comes in to finish people off.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like Mike is the finishing move for every character.
You just bring in the helicopter. 5x5, buddy.
Yeah.
I talked to, in the episode a lot about how it doesn't obviate. To me, the controls don't feel that awkward to me in Resident Evil 4. Like they're different than standard, but it doesn't take me very long to acclimate, and I prefer stopping to shoot in that encounter design.
Yeah,
the encounters are not so dense. Stopping to shoot is like slower and more thoughtful, which I really like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like having both options though.
Yeah,
so doesn't obviate doesn't necessarily mean like, or it necessarily doesn't mean that one is trash and one is great.
Yeah. It'd be a preference thing, and just like Jake said, I can be overjoyed that they're both out there.
So that's it. We're gonna read the Pentiment things here, which contains some spoilers, but before we do that, we're gonna do our wrap up, announce next month's games and everything. If you've listened this far, we appreciate you. If you want to support us, and if you haven't already, you can go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv. $5 a month gives you bonus episodes, including that Resident Evil 4 episode we just talked about, and all of our bonus episodes from the past and the future.
We think it's a good value. You get a whole bunch of stuff, and you can leave ratings or reviews if you would like to. That makes a big difference. This episode is mostly listener responses. If you want to write in about the games that we're playing in July, the deadline is July the 15th. You write in by going to duckfeed.tv/contact and using that form there. If you have thoughts about multiple games, please write multiple responses, one for each, and keep the responses short. You know, about two paragraphs is what we're looking for. We're looking for specificity.
Throwing this out there too. Please don't have your feelings hurt if we don't read your responses. We got a bunch of them. We specifically got a bunch this time. So we try to make the episode flow and have them not take a billion years.
Yes.
So it is not personal. It usually means somebody else said something very similar. And if we just legitimately missed it or anything, apologies.
Yeah. So July's games, if you want to write in about them, they are going to be Burnout Paradise, Jak 2, and the premium episode is going to be Cadence of Hyrule, the Zelda Crypt of the Necromancer game.
Yeah, a Gary pick. It is a good game. It's not like one of my all-time favorites, but I like the idea of Nintendo loosening their licensing, and it is a fun mashup idea.
Yeah.
Taking, you know, one of the things that I think is impeccable about Zelda, like mm-hmm. one of the only thing I mm-hmm. think is impeccable about Zelda, which is the soundtrack yeah. and making it a focus is real fun.
Yeah.
August, we are starting out with Mystical Ninja 64 mm-hmm. Or Mystical Ninja for the Nintendo 64.
Yeah. Mystical Ninja starring Goman for the Nintendo 64.
Yes. So if you've been wondering what Goman's up to, here he is.
What about that lazy perverted scamp Ibisumaru?
Yeah. The idea of I haven't played these. My understanding is there's like a young kid who's a little mm-hmm. muscle boy and then like a old man, and you hang out with this old man and this little muscle boy and you go around.
This also adds a ninja lady, Sasuke.
Oh,
or no, a ninja lady. I forget what her name is. And a little, like a robot, Sasuke. Oh, yeah,
sure. Yeah. Yeah, looking forward to playing that. A Nintendo 64 kind of Zelda like ARPG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we've got our console RPG for the year.
Yes.
Which is two-parter about Dragon Quest IV. Yes. Dragon Warrior IV, if you're nasty.
Yeah. This is we haven't done a mainline Dragon Warrior game.
Which is wild.
Yeah, pretty ridiculous. It is a pillar of that genre. Mm-hmm. This is one I have affection for. It's also one that I built in some antibodies. Like, this is a genre that is not for me in a general sense, but I am playing it on emulator where I can play it in fast forward. Mm. So when it starts getting very slow and you're just grinding out encounters, I can do those at up to 16 times the speed, which I'm really looking forward to because that drives me nuts.
Yeah.
But I also have fond memories of this. Yeah. It's very ambitious for an NES era RPG. Mm-hmm. Has that good, good, charming Dragon Quest music and monsters.
Yeah. And an interesting structure that feels like that feels kind of modern or at least adventurous, having chapters for each of the individual characters before they come together.
Yeah, it does neat stuff. Yeah. Like, it's not as straight a putt as the most recent Dragon Quest game.
Yeah.
Like, this very old one is significantly more ambitious than anything they put out for a while, actually.
Yeah.
In the main line.
Yeah. There are multiple versions of this. Do we want to say we're not doing like how do we want to approach that?
I'm doing the NES version because I need it to be emulated on my Switch.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing the original version.
Or on your Steam Deck, rather.
Or my Steam Deck. I think that we probably will get the gist kind of regardless. Mm-hmm. My understanding is there are changes. I think that if you end up playing a different version, we can discuss those changes. If people are mm-hmm. listening and they notice things are different, mm-hmm. It's been released so many times.
Yeah.
I think that is probably better to not worry about it than to try to pin down a definitive version of it would be my feeling, especially looking through it and trying to find the definitive version of it. There's competing.
It's kind of controversial. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have not decided which one I want to do just yet, because I don't have the same aversion that you do. Like, some of those niceties would be nice, but also, I don't know, those DS remakes are generally pretty well regarded. I understand the mobile one's kind of a disaster, but
I would rather have speed than better graphics for me. But if you'd prefer better graphics, I think the mm-hmm. DS one is probably fine.
I might try both or look up a list of the differences and see. So
Curious, but that is what we're doing for this year. And then finally, the premium episode of the month, this is a Cole pick, and it's one I would have picked if you didn't. So I'm happy about it. Cruelty Squad.
Yeah. Kind of a, let's say a messy immersive sim shooter kind of deal.
Yeah. A scungy immersive sim boomer shooter thing that is intentionally off-putting and grody in its graphics.
Yeah. And with just, from my understanding, some miraculous writing.
Yeah. Yep. Very excited about wallowing around in the scum. It's mm-hmm. a game that I've wanted to play since it came out, basically, and just haven't because of reasons, work reasons and personal.
Yeah.
Both kinds.
Yeah. It's a packed month, as August tends to be. And we are looking forward to having you come along with us.
Yeah. We've said all the stuff. We appreciate
We have not. We appreciate our producer, Gwen.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Gwen. We appreciate you. Mm-hmm. And if you do not want to hear Pentiment responses, duck out now. If you do, duck
Welcome.
In now. Yeah. Welcome back.
Let's see. I read the last one for RE4, so you go ahead.
Autumn says about Pentiment. I loved Pentiment, but had some trouble with the limited time during investigations. I think I had a detective game mindset going in. I was trying to be extremely thorough, but when the first act was over, I felt like I hadn't gone deep enough on any of the suspects. I did better with acts 2 and 3 when I reworked my expectations. Also, if you watch any of Josh Sawyer's videos, you can tell how much of a huge nerd he is for this period.
I mean, I follow him on Twitter. Yeah.
It's like 90% just like absolute dorkery in German. He's very passionate. It's passionate. It's fun to watch somebody be good at something and love something, even if you don't love it.
Yeah.
And he engenders that.
Yes.
And I also had a little bit of an expectation setting thing. So I get that. I think that is going to be one of them. If you can get on board with the low gameplay genre stuff of Pentiment, the fact that it is a deconstructionist game is probably going to be the biggest hurdle people will have. Knowing all of that stuff is intentional is what fixed it for me.
Yeah.
And made it ultimately more interesting than if it had just been a detective game.
Yeah.
Detective games, there aren't very many good ones, I think. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Ethan writes, "Hi. So glad to hear you guys covering Pentiment. I love the direction they took with Andreas Mahler. His personal struggles and self-doubt were something that I found to be very resonant here in the modern day. This is set up early in the first act with Andreas's doubts about his profession and the fear of letting his father down. It's revealed that being an artist was not Andreas's first choice of profession, and that he has switched career paths multiple times, even dropping out of university at one point. His self-doubt and struggle to find something that truly spoke to him partially reflected some of my own feelings going through university. I'm currently 23, and while I'm not upset with my career path thus far, I have my doubts about its viability to support me in an increasingly bleak world. While I'm not tortured with this dissatisfaction like Andreas is, I was still able to relate to the misgivings, to his misgivings in the face of an uncertain future. Andreas's lack of direction is also another point toward him not being able to truly understand the plight of the people in Tassing. At one point, when talking with Mother Illuminata, she chastises Andreas for being so unmoored and directionless, pointing out she was never offered a choice to be anything but a nun, while Andreas squanders his opportunities. It definitely highlights his privileges, and that even the ability to course correct his life is an option that many in the community of Tassing will never get."
Yeah.
Very well put.
Yeah, well put. And I love that he has the opportunity and he still fails at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of that self-doubt, him being right, I think is really key.
Yes.
Like, you're right to self-doubt. This career path isn't for you. Mm-hmm. That happens. So you only get one life, and sometimes you dedicate it to shit that like isn't right.
Yeah. You scotched it.
Yeah. And that's it.
Dump it. It's dumb.
Yeah. That's all you got. It's an amazingly tragic and true thing about real life that happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That it's very rare to find media engage with like clear eyes.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah.
Chris says, "As a history major who has read The Name of the Rose multiple times, I love this. Roger Ebert said movies are empathy machines. That's even more true for a game like this that makes you understand and care about how people that lived and died over 400 years ago. I appreciate that there is a real attempt to show all parts of society, including showing that there are people from every class that are just jerks. I also liked how it was thematically in keeping with Name of the Rose's mystery, which is all about reactionary forces trying to hide knowledge from people. And confession is a major plot point as well. And while the town is fake, St. Moritz is real and was really represented in art as an African. He was from Egypt, which is great for completely insane reactionaries wondering if this game is somehow breaking immersion by showing a non-white person. Looking at you, Kingdom Come Deliverance.
Jesus.
I love how my playthrough was slightly different than most of yours based on who I ate with. I did accuse the monk the first playthrough, but on a second playthrough, just see what happened, I picked Otilla. I think it's deliberately set up that even though she is the least likely suspect physically, literally no one is mad at you if you blame her. I think it's the creators making a point about how easy it is to blame the marginalized. Minor nitpick, Brother Sabbat is not the gay monk. It's Rudigar. The choir guy, and Matthew. Rudigar and Matthew remain together throughout the game, as Rudigar is visible in the background when Matthew writes Mags.
Yeah.
I got my monks mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone in the Slack also mentioned that. A lot of people to know.
Yeah, a whole bunch. Like the game gives you pages and pages of profiles.
Would you like
to
meet 20 monks?
Yeah.
I wasn't planning to, but I guess.
You mean all of them have tonsures?
Like
they would? Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. This is too many monks for me.
But you want to be like this young boy, this little Rudiger.
Yeah. And make love to Matthew in secret.
Yeah.
Well put. I think that one of the things that makes this, you know, the empathy machine line is interesting. It's one of the things that makes Pentiment work where sometimes period pieces don't, is because it does the work to underline and direct the themes that's engaging with to timeless themes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do shorthand and just be like, people of this time period cared about this.
Yeah.
You know, and then you just have to like, okay, well, I don't care about that. That seems ludicrous to me. But I guess I can pretend like I care about it. You know, it takes the things and it does the work to make it resonant.
Yeah.
With now by showing us all those different walks of life. It's by function of showing an entire community that they can show all those different angles of resonance without asking you to take anything on faith.
Yeah.
Like it is not a game about faith and it's not a game about having faith.
Yeah.
Which are two things I don't give a shit about.
It would be a huge mistake to set this entirely within the monastery and make it, you know, all about ecumenical matters.
Yes.
Right. Like that would be so specialized. Yeah.
Well, and it's also, it justifies the genre. Like as much as I might've preferred a little bit less like visual novel, you know, low gameplay reading to it, that would have taken the space of other stuff like text.
Yes.
You know, so they would have been less able to do that kind of thing, I think. Than it is.
Yeah. So, Jack writes, playing Pentiment as a history major had me doing a lot of the Leo pointing meme whenever characters reference something that I knew. That said, what's impressive to me is not just the focus on the details of history, but a deep interest in history as a process. In the course of the game, you see new technology and ideas take hold and the old pass away. And you see how this small village and its people change in just a few decades. The focus on the people is key. Even when you're learning about Tassing's ancient history, you're always being reminded of the effects of that history on the people right now. The people of Pentiment all feel very well observed and show how individuals manage to operate within these much larger forces. Andreas's journey in particular feels significant. His story tied together the idea that history is something to be confronted rather than suppressed on both the community and personal level. Even if the details of pacing and mechanics didn't always work for me, these stories make Pentiment something special.
Yeah, well said. It's basically the point I was making up, like, but better, you know, about it tying things into real life, and it does it because it doesn't ever lose it in people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it understands like what possibly could matter other than that, if you're telling a story about the human heart, you know.
what's more important than people, and like not in a like shitty politician pandering way.
Humans relating to each other is what is interesting about fiction.
It's kind of all there is.
Systems and things influence those humans, but again, compared to another like beautiful narrative game like Disco Elysium, the systems and the oppressive forces that Revachol lives under are important, but they're interesting to the degree that they impact the people we know.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a source book. Like sometimes I do want a source book, but usually that's when there's not a story. Like I choose a source book when something is neither fish nor fowl, you know, and it's like, this is trying to make me care about something, but really it's just a dumb action game.
Yeah.
And there's not enough of this. Just give me the fucking source book.
Yeah.
You know, with something like this, not the case.
Yeah.
It's firmly rooted in people.
Yeah.
Finally, Julia, who sponsored the episode and is a Slack stalwart. She's great. She says, I love Pentiment for too many reasons, but wanted to confess one I don't think people talk about. Andreas is a fuck up. He's snobby. He's self-centered. And he may have gotten someone innocent killed. Mine almost certainly did. Of course, he can also be kind and gentle and compassionate. And the game is about seeing all the fallout in the town from who Andreas is, good and bad. Andreas can't handle this. His guilt and pain weighs him down until finally, near the game and his end, after decades of trauma and isolation, he can finally try to simply let go and be a man who teaches children to draw. I don't think I'm a very good person. I often think of my life as a constant attempt to become a different, better person than I was 5 years ago. And I see so much of myself in Andreas, of being frozen and looking backwards on what went wrong. But the game shows a world that isn't like that. It's a world of people, many of whom fuck up and who try to do better and hold each other closer to try to find some joy in every moment. It's a world where there's forgiveness and peace, even at last for Andreas. Yeah, well said.
I'm not trying to just shorthand it by saying, oh yeah, that's very well put. I think Pentiman has drawn out a lot of very smart and well put observations to rise and match, I think, just the mastery of what it chooses to express and how it expresses it.
Yeah. I love this messy, you know, what Julia's response speaks to, and a lot of the strength of Pentiman is a reality to the characters that is lacking in the medium.
Mm-hmm.
Characters do well and they fuck up and they have feelings about it and forgiveness exists. And we are so used to genre shorthand.
Yeah.
That we don't do that a lot of the time. And that's, you know, I'm okay with that. There are tons of games that don't do that stuff that I'm fine with, but it's Pentiment doesn't require rounding on your part.
No.
To see that stuff. You don't have to pretend, you know, like Cid from Final Fantasy VII is an incredibly deep and nuanced character.
Right.
Like, you know, he's a one little note comedy old guy who has like one little story arc that's kind of good, but he's not Andreas. He's not three dimensional. He doesn't feel real. We don't check in on him enough. It's not that kind of type of game. Right. You don't have to make those compromises.
Right.
With Pentiment. And that's part of why it's so beautiful. So.
Yeah. God. I mean, it's one of those games that is only appreciated in the time since I played it, you know, my head and in regard, you know.
Yeah.
It's one of those. It's a grower.
Great game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great game. And that's going to be it. We've already done all the outro stuff. It's weird.
Yeah. So if you listened, thanks. And we will see you next week talking about Burnout. We're going to go fast.
Yeah. That game did not forget it in people. It is about people who drive cars who you summarily kill to get their cars. it is the Dick Tracy Mega Man approach to driving. Yeah. And it is gloriously dumb.
I want that smash. Vroom, I go fast.
Yeah.